Good morning, and thank you for joining us today for the KRFY Morning Show, right here at 88.5 on our community radio station. And I'm Susie Prez, one of the hosts this morning, co-hosts.
And I'm the second co-host over here, Chris Bessler. Good morning, Susie. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's a little warmer today. It's 19 degrees out this morning.
Yeah, it doesn't feel a whole lot warmer out there. We had a pretty good wind blowing, and that's dropped the wind chill way down.
To two. Yep, exactly.
And we have a great show today. We actually have two different segments. We're going to be talking with two different groups here. In the second half, at 8:30, we're going to be talking with Mel Dick and Alana Westfall from the Sandpoint Rotary Club about this year's CHAFE 150. And then that should be airing right about 8:30. But prior to that, we're going to be featuring an interview with the media scholar who's featured in a film that's showing tonight at the East Monarch Library. And to tell us a little bit about that, we have with us Mike Bauer from the library.
Good morning.
Mike, what's happening at the library tonight?
6 p.m. We are screening the digital disconnect film at the East Bonner County Library, and it will be a film that will run about 54 minutes, and it will cover the internet and how it's kind of being taken over by four or five companies, and democracy is being compromised somewhat by that, and it's being moderated by Dr. and Professor Robert McChesney, who covers the history of the internet and how it's been developed that way. And there'll be a discussion afterwards. And our moderator will be...
Well, I'll be chipping in to help facilitate the discussion tonight. Yeah.
Yes, so. And it will be in our big room. So we expect a lively discussion and a number of people that will come and provide both sides of this issue.
We certainly hope. It's open to everybody. Anybody that's got an opinion about the internet, what they think the internet is doing to society, what they think free market forces are doing to the internet, this film covers all these things. It's really quite eye-opening, actually.
It really is.
I have a question. Mike, how did you come up with this as a subject? And is this part of a larger educational offering from the library?
It really is. One of the missions of the library is to be a hub for community discussion. We want both sides of issues to be in our new big room. And we want moderators to come in and just to have the community to have really productive discussions, and I think the community needs to come together with some of those productive discussions, and we want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And what is your position at the library that you're heading this up?
You know, the American Library Association is all about free speech, and free speech is the ability of anybody to be able to talk, and also part of that, I think, is the responsibility to listen. And so we will be talking about, you know, some guidelines tonight, some respect. And so I think that'll be Chris's job to be able to,
so
to moderate
that. Like
I don't put you on the spot, aren't I?
Yeah. No, it'll be fun. Actually, I'm looking forward to, hopefully folks will come that have opinions across the spectrum. Actually, it's a very eye-opening film, and even if you don't have much of an opinion about what's happening with the internet and how the internet is impacting your life, this film will be very educational for you.
So that'll be 6 p.m. tonight at East Bonner County Library at Sandpoint Branch.
And that's at 1407 Zeter Street.
Exactly.
Plenty of parking.
Mm-hmm.
You both, Mike Bauer and Chris Bessler, had the opportunity to sit down, not sit down, but to call in with Professor Robert McChesney last week. And so that's what we're offering here this morning. But before we get to that, and even an introduction to that, let me just give you the weather from the National Weather Service. Currently, it's 19 degrees out today. Oh, my goodness. I just noticed we have a 90% chance of snow. That's a new word, isn't it? Snow. I did hear that over there in California, where they have the big ski resorts up on top of the Sierras, whatever that, Tahoe, they're expecting 4 to 8 feet in the next 3 days. So keep that in mind when the snow comes here. Our snow accumulation is less than 1 inch tonight and 1 to 2 inches today. The high today is 29, low tonight 19. Tomorrow, 80% chance of snow, high of 31, and low Thursday night of 20.
Susie, do you see any forecast for winds there? Because we've been getting a lot of wind, and I'm just wondering if we can expect more of that.
You know, I'm not – well, winds 3 to 6 miles per hour, it's right around there. I'm not seeing those gusts up to 25 or 30 that we were having. Not yet, but who knows? Weather changes quickly.
It is North Idaho.
After all.
And other things going on around town very quickly. Well, the big thing is the Follies are showing Friday and Saturday. That's a variety show that's kind of raunchy and risque, so a warning if you're going to that. But you're probably not going unless you already have a ticket because it's sold out.
Two nights, and it really supports a great cause. It's Angels Over Sandpoint.
Angels Over Sandpoint.
And do the, incredible things in our community.
Supports their backpack program for the schools. Another big thing happening this weekend is Mega Demo Day. It's up at Schweitzer, and this is a chance to try out new boards and skis. And the money raised there benefits the Panhandle Alliance for Education. So that's a charitable cause as well.
Very good.
Yeah, and of course, there's a ton of other things going on. You can see that on our website, kfy.org. Or on sandpointonline.com, which provides the calendars. Anyways, ton of stuff happening.
Yeah, so we might as well get to our recorded interview. One of you can introduce it, but before, just want to remind you, stay with us at the end of the interview, or around the end of the half hour, right around 8:30, we'll have some live guests in the studio with Chafe 150 Grand Fondo that's coming up in June. We'll hear all about it. So introduce our recorded interview.
Okay, this is Chris Bessler and myself interviewing Dr. Robert McChesney of the Digital Connect Disconnect movie last week.
Okay, we'll be back at 8:30. Stay with us.
We're here with Robert McChesney. He's professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois, and he's the media scholar featured in the new documentary film, Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And that's based on his book of the same name. Professor McChesney, thank you for taking this time to talk with us today.
My pleasure to be here.
So just to set this up a little bit, I'll tell a little bit about the film. Digital Disconnect provides a broad overview that documents the birth of the internet as a government-subsidized project, which some folks aren't even aware of, probably, to the remarkable ways that today it now influences almost all aspects of our society, especially with the rise of social media. There's been a lot of discussion about what the internet is doing to individuals or how individuals are using the internet, but I think your film, Professor McChesney, takes a larger, more systemic look at how giant companies and capitalism itself has changed the internet in major ways. Professor McChesney, let's start with your thoughts on how has the internet changed communications and the media before we talk about how capitalism is changing the internet itself.
Well, that's not a very easy question to answer. You hit me at the top one because it's very complex. On one hand, it's very simple. Clearly, the internet has made it possible to have rapid communication and access to wealth of material instantaneous. And it's changed our society dramatically. When you add in social media and cell phones and wireless communication, put the whole package together, we live in a world today that basically is almost antithetical, or at least it's radically divergent from just the world of a generation or two generations ago. People 30 or 40 years ago would have no idea what the world they were about to enter. Young people today in college, when I tell them what my experience was like in the 70s, how people communicated or got information, they almost think we were living, you know, in like cavemen or something. They can't imagine how human beings could even survive in that environment where you weren't in constant, immediate touch with everyone 24/7. So, yeah, it's been a revolution, such an immense one. It takes time to pause to really see the extent of it. So at that point, it's crucial. Now, as for our media system, it's had dramatic effects on media, culture, entertainment, journalism, some for the better and some very much for the worse.
To follow up on that question, some of the ways it has impacted the media negatively, I saw a figure 20 years ago about over 80% of households received a daily newspaper, and now the number that receive a daily newspaper are fewer than 50%.
Yeah, and given the quality of daily newspapers, I think it's that figure is going to be approaching 0% probably within a decade. And there's they get progressively worse as they lose their revenue base, so they have less reporting and original material. And so people can find that sort of material easily enough online. There's no reason to get paper and ink. But you're right. The crucial problem is not the loss of newspapers. It's the collapse of journalism, the practice of journalism. We have far fewer working journalists today than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's been a dramatic collapse in the practice of journalism. So the huge sections of public life that used to be covered by competing independent newsrooms now get no coverage whatsoever. Or you have one newsroom that might sort of cover it superficially, but with no competitive pressure to do a good job, no one watching them. So the work is predictably lame. This is a major crisis of American society. Most Americans are unaware of it because if you go to the Internet, it seems like you're flooded with data and information. It seems like there must be all sorts of journalism going on. But when you actually lift the hood and look underneath and see what's there, what you find is that most state governments hardly have any coverage anymore. Many states down to one or two reporters that might actually be covering the state house. And depending on the size of the state, that's a huge fall from just 25, 30 years ago. Now, is the Internet entirely responsible for the freefall collapse of journalism? No. But it is largely responsible for the fact that the commercial model of journalism is dead and will never return, because that commercial model was based on advertising support, which really paid for about 80% of all the revenues that supported journalism in the United States. But advertisers never supported journalism because they cared about journalism. It was purely opportunistic. Buying ads in newspapers and news media was a way to reach their target audience. In the age of the Internet, they no longer need to support content to reach their final audience, their target audience. They can go online, place their ads, and we know that they'll everywhere we are online. The surveillance capacity of the Internet is so intense. And the advertisers can find you wherever you are. They don't need to buy an ad on a newspaper to grab you. And as a result, news media do not have the revenues, and they are in free fall collapse. The smartest capitalists in our society, the smartest businesses, have abandoned journalism. They don't think you can make money doing it, and they're absolutely right.
So do you think the big media companies, are they influencing the reporting and news in the media companies? We're really seeing a polarization of media, Fox News, CNN. I mean, they're kind of having political viewpoints in their reporting. Are you seeing an influence in that area?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think the collapse of actual reporting, the disintegration of it, is really exemplified by something like Fox News and the other networks you mentioned, but especially Fox News. A lot of people think the revolution of Fox News was that it brought explicitly partisan reporting to television news. Really, like, they made no pretense that they were objective, neutral, nonpartisan. I mean, they might have made a pretense, but no one took it seriously. And they just basically said, we're with the Republicans, that's our team, and we're going to be there. We're there, they're propped up. We're representing their viewpoint on all issues. And really, though, that's not the Fox News revolution. The Fox News revolution in the 1990s was they realized that they could do a news channel and make a fortune by doing no reporting. I mean, they don't ever cover anything. They have no reporters. They don't do journalism, per se. They basically just have celebrity blowhards on the air who just present talking points for the Republican Party in an entertaining, bombastic manner. And that is exceptionally profitable because your costs go way down when you don't have any reporters and you just have blowhards on the air. And that's all they've got. And so when you lose core journalism, you don't have much left. Basically, you're reduced to what they do at Fox and CNN and MSNBC, which is endless gossip on who's going to be the Democratic candidate for president. We're already in the middle of hours every day of absolutely meaningless, nutritionless garbage about who's going to be the Democratic nominee. Not a single vote will be cast for a year on that. All we learn are their mindless predictions. Well, that's cheap and expensive stuff to do. That's not reporting. So I think that if you're not going to have reporting, then you've got to offer something. And what these networks have discovered is the thing you offer in that context is your opinions, and you be entertaining, you pick sides in the debate. Otherwise, people have no reason to watch you. If you have no news and you have no opinion, then you're nothing.
Yeah, it's actually a contradiction, isn't it? We have more information available to us now than ever, but instead of broadening our perspectives, it's acting to actually harden us into narrower viewpoints, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't get too hung up on that. I mean, I know everyone does. It's a popular thing that we're in our silos and we're hardened and, you know, it's ironic with all this information. For one thing, I would say, there's a lot of data out there, but there's not that much information about a lot of stuff. It's garbage. There's no coverage of the State House in Wisconsin to speak of. There aren't any reporters covering it. There's City Hall or all sorts of issues. Now, you might find a lot of nonsense online in a Google search related to something, but we aren't going to find much actual reporting on what's being done. So I don't think there's a lot out there. There's just a lot of, there's a blizzard of data. Bits and bytes, but that's not the same thing as credible journalism or any sort of journalism, incredible journalism. And so, you know, I think people go into these so-called silos because there's nowhere else to go necessarily. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not like there's a lot of options really otherwise.
So how do you see the ISPs taking advantage of the repeal of net neutrality? Is anything happening now?
Yeah, the cable and phone companies, which are government-created monopolies, these are companies that couldn't win free market competition if their life depended on it. They exist because they got monopoly licenses from the government. They had no competition in the cable companies and phone companies historically. And then they parlayed their extremely gifted lobbying prowess, because their whole business model is getting these government contracts, monopoly licenses. They've parlayed that into control over access to the internet. Basically, that's who you're getting your internet access from, one of a very small number of companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. And what this whole battle over net neutrality is about is that these companies want to take their dominance of internet service provision, of having access to the internet, and privatize it so they can basically set up toll booths all over the internet to make more money. And, you know, this is something that is, you know, dreadful from the perspective not only of people and citizens and people using that, but even for most other businesses that don't understand why these monopolists should be allowed to set up toll booths. And most Americans oppose it because they know it's going to make the internet more expensive and less open. That's what the struggle is. So they're going to try in ways to charge more, and they have no competition to speak of. They own the government. The FCC under the Trump administration is a wholly owned subsidiary of the cable and phone companies. But it's not a dead issue. While Trump and his incredibly corrupt people at the FCC he's appointed, while they will, they've gotten rid of net neutrality, I think in 2 years it'll be back in place. If, of course, they haven't put it back in place before then.
So that goes to one of the big themes that are in your film, and that is how economic forces are shaping the internet we have today. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, when the internet began, and you alluded to this in the introduction, when the internet began, it was for decades, from the 60s, 70s, 80s into the 90s, it was an entirely non-commercial, non-profit undertaking. In fact, any commercialism was banned on the internet until the 1990s. And I was there at the beginning, and some of you may have been too, or some of the people in your audience at the film tonight may well be from the generation that remembers when the internet first really became popular in the early 1990s with the advent of the World Wide Web. And then people started going online between 1990, 91, and 94 or 5, and then it exploded. And even at that early moment, no one figured out how you could make money on it. It was clear this was a revolutionary phenomenon, but it was entirely unclear where the money was going to be made, what they called the killer application would be. And that lasted for a long time. Except for internet service provision, no one was really sure what you could do online to make money. And then that all changed, and it changed for a variety of reasons, but it before it changed in the 1990s, if you were to read any book about the internet, the assumption was that it was going to be the greatest help for capitalism ever, that it was going to make capitalism much more democratic, much more competitive. It would open up opportunities for entrepreneurs and small businesses to compete with the big guys. It was a win-win for the human race. The only losers in the 1990s from the emergence of the internet was going to be those big, clumsy corporations that wouldn't be able to keep up with the nimble entrepreneurs online. It was going to be a glory age of capitalism coming. Well, regrettably, the exact opposite has been the case. And that's something no one anticipated in the 1990s, and now it's we live with it. And I think in Digital Disconnect, the book, which came out in 2013, and then the subsequent film that you're watching, I go through that because it's something I've been chronicling. And the irony is that the internet, rather than being a source of spectacular competition, has been the greatest generator of economic monopoly in the history of capitalism. By far, there's not even a second or third place. It's unbelievable what an extraordinary mechanism of monopoly that it has become, such that the five dominant companies on the internet are all basically there because they have big areas online where they're the main company. They're the monopoly provider, and they have no real competition. And these are the companies we all know, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft. Facebook might have slipped a little bit, but for a long time, and maybe still, those were the five most valuable companies in the world economy, certainly the five most valuable in the United States. Facebook, because of its problems, might have slipped down to seven or eight globally, but the other four are the top four. And so these are companies that are, you know, we've never had an industry that's dominated the list of largest firms, most valuable firms like this ever before in the history of capitalism, all from this one sector. And they're there because they're monopolies. Investors say this is, you can't go wrong with companies that are monopolies. And it's important to understand that when you use the term monopoly in economics, it doesn't mean that you have a monopoly in the sense that it's only one company that provides the service. A monopoly in economics means you have a company so large it can control how much competition it has. Even John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil at its peak, never refined, I think, more than 82 or 83% of the oil in the United States. There were other oil refineries, but he had controlled enough of it that he could basically set the price and determine how much competition he ever had with Standard Oil. And that's what these big companies have. So we have an internet that doesn't have a lot of burgeoning entrepreneurs. We have these big guys that completely own the field. And this is a real crisis for democracy because there's one thing that's almost an axiom of democratic theory, is that monopolistic control over the economy is incompatible with democracy because the big guys have way, way, way too much power. And people in the northwest of this country, in the Rocky Mountains in Idaho and Montana, probably know this well because they lived through these great struggles 100 years ago, as did the people in the upper Midwest. That was the great battle of that era.
So what are the steps American citizens can take, both on the larger issues surrounding the future use of the internet as well as their own personal use, to protect themselves in this situation?
Well, these are political issues. So, you can floss your teeth and wash your hands after you go to the bathroom. You do all the personal stuff you want. But in the end of the day, these are broad social political issues that have to be met with public policy to have really fundamental change. So we need policies like net neutrality, preventing the privatization of the internet by the phone and cable companies. We need to have really strict surveillance prohibitions so that people can have genuine privacy and not be spied on without their permission. That's an interesting thing. You have to give permission to be spied on. We also need to have public policy to rejuvenate journalism so we actually have independent competing newsrooms covering our communities. It's very hard to imagine a functioning democracy without journalism. In fact, it's impossible. We're very close to testing that theory in the United States today, and it's maybe one of the reasons we have someone like we do in the White House today. It's a journalism-free environment is a playground for tyrants and frauds. So those are places to start. I think also we have to look at these big monopolies that run the internet, like the big five, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. And we have to ask ourselves, as America did 125 years ago, what can we do about this sort of concentrated monopolistic wealth these firms have? And maybe we should start thinking about them rather than private for private companies out to satisfy investors, but make them into public utilities since they provide a service that they monopolistically control that's so important. And this is important to explain. The reason why we have so much monopoly power online isn't that these entrepreneurs are so much smarter than all the other CEOs in America for the last 100 years. The reason is that they are beneficiaries of what are called network effects, which means that if you control a network, and almost all internet business is a network, the way it works is that whoever is in first place gets all the business because networks get exponentially stronger when they add people, and the second, third, fourth place networks all collapse eventually. So if you're going to do social media, you're going to use Facebook. I mean, if you go to MySpace, there'll only be 10 other people in the world who are on MySpace. You have no one in your to play with. You go to Facebook, you've got 2 billion people that you can play with. So the number one company in social media wins the battle. Same thing with Google search. Who are you going to use, Google or some search engine that, you know, doesn't have hardly any traffic and is much less reliable? If you're going to buy a book online, who are you going to go to, the company that's got Amazon, that's got every book and warehouses all over the place and can charge much less, or some other service? Well, 99% of Americans pick Amazon for that reason. So these are monopolies that are created by the nature of the internet, the digital world, not because their entrepreneurs deserve monopoly status or people want it. And maybe it's time to say these sort of monopolies just are incompatible if we're going to live in a free society. They're the sort of things you'd find in a feudal and an undemocratic world.
You know, as we're coming into this next political season here, these are huge issues. How can people move the needle? How can they get the candidates talking about these things?
Well, some of the candidates are, fortunately. You know, you'll see some of the, and I think these issues will continue to emerge. You know, I think in the Democratic side, we're seeing Senator Warren, Senator Sanders have taken up these issues. And I think the other senators, from what I can see, they seem to be jump on the bandwagon when an issue catches on. So if there's momentum, I think the other senators or the other candidates will start talking about it, too. And I think, you know, but I agree, we've got a long way to go. And I think asking candidates about it, pushing them on it, in particular, I think the one I would say, if you have no other issues, the issues of surveillance, of monopoly and journalism. Those three are the crucial ones that Americans should constantly pester candidates about and get their attention, because they have to be solved. And if we don't have journalism, it's game over.
So, Professor McChesney, we've only got a minute or two left here, but what would you like viewers to get out of the film?
Well, to understand that the internet that we see today, that my children have grown up in and assume it's sort of the natural order of things, is the result not of market forces or freedom or political debate, but it was really, it's the result today of powerful companies taking over, changing the protocols so that you could have surveillance, which was impossible to do in the 1990s, but it got changed to make it more profitable. And that the sort of power of these companies that dominate it is something that can be addressed politically. There's nothing natural about it, and it has to be addressed politically. This is a political issue, first and foremost. It shouldn't be. This film is not sort of a picture of a landscape over which people have no control, like the Rocky Mountains, but rather it's a picture of a landscape that is our own creation, and we need to understand that and change it to something that works for us, not against us.
Are you optimistic for the future?
Very.
Because of the ability of our people to actually coalesce around this?
I'm optimistic because I teach college students all the time. So I've been doing it for about 40 years, 35 years now. And I would say in the last decade, I've seen a fundamental shift take place among young people. Much more openness to being asking critical questions. I think the system doesn't work as well for young people. So the idea that you just mind business, do what you're told, and you're going to get a good job and you can live happily ever after, that sort of thing that I grew up with and my generation grew up with, that doesn't apply anymore. Some people that applies for, but for most, life is a struggle, and they know their life's going to be a lot worse than their parents and they're a lot worse than their grandparents. And as a result, they're open to thinking critically, saying, okay, maybe we can do better. This is, why do we have this outrageous situation? And I think in that context, I think we see an openness to sort of new ideas and experimentation that really hasn't been very common in the United States for a long time.
Professor McChesney, thank you again for speaking with us. Again, your film, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, will be shown tonight at the East Bonner County Library at 6 p.m. And we hope all our listeners will come and take in the film. There's a ton more there than we've touched on here, and join us in the discussion. Thank you again, Robert.
Hey, my great pleasure, Adam, and thank you for showing the film. I hope people enjoy it.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And we are back live in the KRFY studios for the rest of the morning show. We have new guests. And you just heard Digital Disconnect author Professor Robert McChesney with a recorded interview with Chris Bessler and Mike Bauer. So,
yeah, but now we're going to turn to a whole new subject. We have with us now Mel Dick and Ilana Westfall from the Sandpoint Rotary Club. They're getting ready to do the Chafe 150 Grand Fondo bike ride again this year, coming up Saturday, June 15th. And there's a ton of new stuff going on with it, I know. Ilana, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And Mel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Before we dive into some of the new stuff that's happening with the ride itself, there's new distances. Tell us about the cause, because the cause is a new cause this year.
Yes, for the last 6 years, the cause has been for the Lake Pend'Oreille School District students that were in their special needs program, with an emphasis on those on the autism spectrum. That cause morphed into a broader social and emotional well-being cause for the school. And the school did just a fantastic job doing that. For over the six-year period, Rotary donated over $260,000 to that cause. Our cause for this year and for the next 2 years is going to be on the school's a reading curriculum and an after-school reading literacy program at two of the schools is where we're starting out this year, Farm and Stidwell and Kootenai. And I can tell you, it's a fantastic thing. If you can get a chance, go out and observe these kids and what they're doing with reading and the after-school reading program. The reason this is so important is that on a national scale and locally, we're no different. Approximately 50% of the students that go into the third grade are not proficient in reading where they need to be. And the adage is you learn to read by the time you're in the third grade. And after the third grade, you're reading to learn. So we know statistically, if you come out of the third grade and you're not ready to read, you're going to stay behind, and you're probably going to have a chance to be behind for your entire life in terms of careers. So that's why this cause is really, really, really important.
So this new cause has really caught your attention due to some of those statistics that you just mentioned. And it's a two-year cause.
Yes, we're committed for this year's ride, and the next 2 years rides after that will go to support this cause. In addition, a portion of the ride also supports some of the other local programs that Rotary does here locally. But the big cause component of it is really the schools.
Okay, so that's a good start to our talk, because all the folks out there who love to read and want to help kids get a good start in life by becoming readers themselves, that's what the Chafe 150 is all about this year. But there's a ton of new stuff that should be of interest as well to people that just love to ride bikes. So why don't we start with there's some new distances this year.
That's right. This year, we've expanded Chafe, and you can ride 150 miles, 100 miles, 80 miles, 40 miles, 30 miles, or you can ride from City Beach out to Dover Bay as part of our family fun ride, which is going to be a really terrific event, which we can talk a little bit more about. But we have rides for every level of rider. It's going to be really exciting.
And so the one that's kind of scary for me is kind of a, you know, casual bike rider is that 150 distance. But actually, that's one of the things that sets the Chafe apart as kind of a ride for elite riders, right, Mel?
No question. On a national scale, we were ranked as the third best charity ride in the country last year by Bicycling Magazine, which is by far the major publication for road riders. And, you know, the ride started out with only one route, which was 150 miles. We have a number of riders. In fact, the 150 historically has been our biggest ridership because it really challenges you. 150 miles in one day is doable. We've had people ride that ride who, you know, really haven't trained hardly at all, and they can do it, but it just takes, you know, 12 plus hours to do it. The addition of the 100-mile route, which really starts where the same place that the 80-mile route does, and it gives you an opportunity once you get to really the Sully Valley area to join up with the 30 and 40-mile routes and add an extra 20 miles to it. So it's really just an addition, if you will, as opposed to a totally new separate route. The 40-mile is really the same. It's just an extension of 10 miles onto the existing 30-mile route. The route that I'm really excited about, quite frankly, is the Family Fun Ride. In Rotary, we have a big Rotary family. We have Interact groups that are at the high school. We have a new group here in town called Rotaract, and Rotaract is for young people ages 13 to 30. And then, obviously, you have Rotary after that. Well, we have a brand new Interact club here. They've got about 15 members already, and they are really taking charge and leading the effort in the Family Fun Ride. And if you think about that ride, it's all about kids. It's all about reading. It's going to be about a lot of fun once you get out to Dober Bay. There's going to be face painting. There will be things like a bouncy castle, reading books. In fact, one of the things we're encouraging parents who accompany their children, because we're not going to charge for children, or I'm sorry, for parents, we're going to charge $10 as an entry fee for kids that are six and over. But we encourage everybody to bring a book as a donation that will go into some reading program somewhere in the schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that ride, you know, that's anybody can do that ride. It's on the bike path, right? And it so you're separated from traffic. And it's not very far. It's almost completely flat. So if you're not a big bike rider, this is one way to get involved with the cause and support the cause. Now, on the other routes, you mentioned that somebody's done the 150 without training. And I'd say I'd never try that without training. The longer routes you do want to train for. I did the 80 a few years ago, and I did it a few times, actually. And it's a ton of fun. If you're not familiar with the route, it starts at City Beach, goes north up Highway 95, a little bit north of Bonner's Ferry, gets onto Highway 2, over to Troy, and then it comes down through the Bull River Valley and then back along Highway 200. Gorgeous route. You must get that kind of feedback that people like the route.
A number of years ago, we renamed one of the top 10 scenic rides in the country, and one of the reasons you ride is that whole ride down the Bull River is absolutely amazing. I mean, I've ridden thousands of miles around the country, and that is by far my favorite section of any riding I've ever done. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. And it's going to be interesting to add the 20 miles onto the old 80 route, because that takes you into the Sully Valley, which is like prime bicycling territory as well.
Well, when you're riding in the Sully Valley and you're in mid-June and you see the snow-capped mountains, when you're looking over at Schweitzer and you see the alpacas and the alpaca farm out there, and everything is green.
Profusely green.
It is. I mean, it's spectacular.
Yeah.
I just want to say it. One of the stops, you have these great stops. KRFY will be there at the Pack River store again this year. And we really have a lot of fun out there, too, with great food. But you were going to say something.
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to say. My best favorite part of the ride is the brake stops, of course. You'll do the brake stop for the 30 and the 40-mile route there at the Pack River store. Always lots of great fun and great things to eat. And every one of our brake stops is fully stocked.
And one thing I noticed one year when I was out there helping, everyone's so excited and having such a great time. It's really fun. This ride is not just about the distance or things like that. It's about the giving that's really behind the Rotary's whole idea of this. But it's just fun.
Right. Because, you know, each rider gets to set up their own fundraiser page through CrowdRise. And when you register, you're automatically, given the sequence of doing that. And then you really involve everybody in your life with it. You're raising money for kids in our local community. And, you know, when you look at the children who are going to have the opportunity to go to these after school programs, who have never been able to do something like that, you realize that every single dollar you raise is going to make a big difference in somebody's life.
Yeah, you know, the times I rode the 80, the way I put it out there is on the fundraising part of it was, hey, I'm doing this ride. And 80 was pushing it for me, to tell you the truth. I'd never done a ride like that. And you know, will you pledge a little bit for each mile I make, you know, and, And I found there were a lot of people that, you know, said, yeah, go for it. And I think I actually, I was fortunate I had one big donor, but I think I raised over $1,000 on my ride.
Wow.
The last time I did it. So it's really possible for the riders to really raise a significant amount of money from among their friends and family who want to support them in their fundraising.
That's true.
Well, we've had riders in the past who've raised over $4,000. And I'm going to let Alana share with you some of the things you get when you do this fundraising.
That's right, Chris. When you sign up for the 100 this year and you raise that $4,000, you're going to be able to win a Salsa Journeyman bike. That's a $1,500 road bike. And you're going to get a jersey, a custom designed limited edition jersey, and a registration for next year. And if you raise $2,500, you'll get a Garmin GPS Edge heart rate monitor, which is, I'm going for that this year. I'm really trying to get there. You get a jersey and a 2020 registration. $1,000, you get a home mechanic kit for your bike. If you raise $500, you get a jersey that's a value of $80, and you get a 2020 registration. Even if you raise $250, you're going to get a registration for the following year. And every single dollar you raise, you get the satisfaction of knowing you're helping a child.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, of course, this is the whole idea here is to raise funds for this good cause of early childhood literacy. Of course, fundraising by the individual riders isn't the only important source of support for this. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about the sponsors?
Yeah, we have an amazing community here in terms of giving. This year's ride, we're still in our sponsorship drive. We set a pretty lofty goal. We have 100 sponsors who are supporting the ride this year. And that represents well over $100,000 of cash contributions and in-kind contributions that there's cost to put on a ride of this size, you know, with the breakfast, the rest stops, etc. So I'm telling you, it's just amazing what Sandpoint has done. We've heard a number of people really, you know, our community gets behind the schools, as you know, and this is just a wonderful opportunity for people to participate. So if you want to sponsor, you can simply go to our website and you can check out how to sponsor there, but contact me or Alana or anybody else for that matter in Rotary.
Mm-hmm. And you already have a couple of big sponsors you might want to mention.
Right. We do. Our platinum sponsors this year are Ting, Crazy Fast Internet, and Timberline Helicopters is a platinum sponsor this year, and they were a gold sponsor last year. Mm-hmm. So it's really great to have them on board, and their contributions are significant to getting the ride to happen and all the things that we get to add on, too.
And we also have over 20 sponsors that are at the $2,500 or above level, you know, just short of the platinum sponsorship of $5,000 in some cases. And I would like to, if I have a minute, just kind of give a shout out to all of those. We've got Washington Trust, Safeway, Keoki Publishing, Bonner General Health, Northland Cable, The Daily Bee, North Idaho Flood and Fire, Living Local, 7B TV, Williams and Parsons, Angela Oaks Insurance Consulting, Kachava, Ponderay Mechanical, Lighthouse, Parker Subaru, Greasy Fingers, KPND, Trinity at City Beach, Lone Tree Creative, and the 219 Lounge. So very, very well there. Of those 100 sponsors we have, quite frankly, we have 20 at the, two at the platinum level, 20 at the gold level. We have over 20 at the silver level, 30 plus at the bronze level. So these are people that are putting significant amounts of dollars behind this cause.
And as you said, many in-kind donations also.
Many, many in-kind donations.
And you have some upcoming fundraisers also. Chances for folks to come and hear more about the ride and get registered, but also fundraising.
Yeah, and you know, the great thing about these fundraisers, it's a happy hour. So that's a lot of fun, right? The first one is going to be Wednesday, March 13th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Idaho Poor Authority. We're going to have great raffles. We're going to have some swag to give away, live music, beer specials. You know, the Idaho Poor Authority gives back a portion of all of your beer purchases to the chafe. And what else, Mel? You get to meet the team. You get to meet other people who are riding. That's really great. And you get to drink great beer. Exactly.
Bike riders like great beer.
Yeah, it's the carb thing, right?
Yes, you have to carbo load so that you can do that 100-mile ride.
Right, and you can start 2 months early carbo loading. You definitely can.
Yeah.
So we're going to have that. We'll have two more in April and May at the 219 and Matchwood Brewing as well. We'll get back to you on the dates with that before they happen. So, you know, come out. Meet everybody.
Yeah.
Get a buddy to ride with. That brings me to the team idea.
There we go. You have teams as well.
We have teams that sign up every year. Last year, Bonner General rode, and they rode again. I mean, we have fun names for teams. You know, people name their teams. There's the Chain Smokers and the Double Entendre there, and the Blazing Saddles.
I bet there wasn't a real smoker in the group.
No, I think bike chains.
Yeah, got it. Yeah.
But, you know, the great thing about riding with somebody else is it motivates you.
So, how does a team ride work? Just everybody has to come across the finish line together?
No, you really don't even have to do that. But, you know, a lot of times they wear the same jersey. Or, you know, they name their teams. They fundraise together. They, you know, have group rides together. So,
Now that brings up the question that this is a ride and not a race, but it's also a Gran Fondo. Tell us what that is.
Gran Fondo is Italian for big ride. This year, our timed ride routes are going to be 150, 180 mile routes. And so you can challenge yourself each year and check your time. So it'll be professionally timed.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of really neat riders. Last year, we had a rider from Cranbrook, Canada, and he is a unique individual. Along with two others, had the fastest time, which was a little bit less than 7 hours for the 150-mile ride. He is a gold medal Paralympic champion, and he is a world champion in terms of time trials and sprints. He is going to come back to the ride this year, and we are planning to have a ride registration dinner the day of registration, which is on June 14th in the afternoon. And Tristan Chernov is going to speak to a limited group of about 150 people. And it's going to be, if you're into cycling, the opportunity to see a world-class rider and hear from a world-class rider. And he has an affliction that is similar to MS, and that's why he got into bike riding, and now he's a world champion. And if you looked at him, he would probably be finishing pretty high up in the Tour de France.
Mm-hmm.
He's just an amazing individual. Then we have the other end of the spectrum, where we have Jerry Schwartz, who's going to ride the 80-mile ride. And Jerry, last year at 87, took an hour off of his time from the year before. He's 88 now, and he has been working with a trainer, and he hopes to take even more time off of his 80-mile ride this year. In fact, Chris, he could probably pace you on your century.
I have no doubt he could.
So
I also did the Long Bridge swim a few years ago, and Sister Mary Bruder totally smoked me. She was in her 80s. So I'm humble in that way, Mel.
We have something exciting this year, too, that in terms of riding. There's a new trend in riding in different types of bicycles called e-bikes. And what an e-bike is it's a regular bike. It's got a little electronic motor and battery that comes with it. And you can ride that bike as though it's a regular bike. But if you need just a little assistance getting up that little hill, or the wind's a little bit too hard for you, you can kick in and you can use that little motor. We're going to allow those bikes on the 30 and 40 mile routes, and obviously the family fun route. They're tough to support because there's a whole different set of mechanic issues and things like that involved with them. But it's really a growing trend. And so, again, Chris, not to say that you can't do that 100. Most of the battery packs are good for about 60 miles. So there's another opportunity to really get your century pass.
Hey, I'm not going to be lugging a battery along. Sorry, Mel. That's not the deal.
Well, it's my plan to have an e-bike when I'm 90 and ride across the country
again. There you go.
Again.
90, that makes sense right there.
You could just bring the cord and charge it at the rest stops, of course. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, traditionally, we've had more male riders than female riders. Last year, it was 67% male riders. And I'm just pointing this out because, hey, women out there, come on. let's get riding. Let's get it up to 50%.
I'm with you on that.
All right.
And it is terrific exercise. You know, it really to do, I think, to do this ride, even if you're only doing a 30 or 40 mile distance, is to get out on your bike and do some rides in advance and do a bit of training. And the thing about bike riding is it's fun, but it's also excellent aerobic exercise.
And it's so beautiful here.
And you can be out there training now if you want to train outside, but also there's a number of places locally that offer spin classes. I know I participate occasionally in the YMCA spin class, and there's just a lot of fun doing that.
This week we're going to have training plans up on the website and our Facebook page, which don't forget to go to those, and they're going to help you get along with your training for the season.
And the website is?
www.chafe150.org.
Yeah. And it is a new website this year, and it's beautiful.
I noticed. I looked at it this morning, and you're right. It's beautiful. And I just want to say I'm really glad that you added the family ride, because all those hundreds of little kids that will be out there riding to Dover, they're your future 150s,
right,
or 80s or 100s. And you have a lot of options for folks.
That's probably your nefarious plan, isn't it?
Get them
while they're young, and within 10 years, they'll be doing the 150.
Yeah.
And they're going to have a police escort on the way out of town to the Dover Trail, so that'll be a lot of fun. I mean, that's a great part of the ride.
They'll start a little bit later than the adult riders.
A little later
on the
than
150,
the
yeah.
30 and the 40.
Yeah, they'll start somewhere around 12:45 to 1 o'clock. And there will, from a safety perspective, there's the police escort out. They'll hook up with the bike path over near the Greenery District. And where there are intersections, there will be people there directing the riders in traffic.
This is a big endeavor. Do you need volunteers? How do you put this together? It's huge.
The Rotary Club works 9 months out of the year to put this ride on, and it takes over 100 volunteers. I mean, it's a big commitment by our whole club, and it's great that we have 100 sponsors from the community and that we get over 100 volunteers.
Well, and it's not just Rotary. Rotary's membership is about 85, and the vast majority of our members participate in one way or another during the ride or throughout the year. But the break stops, one of the neat things about the break stops is they're manned by other community organizations. You mentioned the break stop that the radio will be doing out at the Pack River Store, but Friends of Scotchman's Peaks, they do the Clark Fork break stop. Angels Over Sandpoint does the Troy stop. The school district does two stops, one up in Bonner Ferry and one at Yak Hill, and then the Rotary itself does two break stops. It's a huge effort just to coordinate the break stops. And then there'll be a break stop, obviously, out at the Family Fun Ride, which will be with the Rotaract Club
in Dover Bay.
But in the park right by Dover Bay City Hall.
You know, we haven't yet mentioned, everybody ends up at City Beach, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, you start at City Beach for everybody. 150-mile riders, they have a great breakfast. They take off at about 6, 6:30. The 80 and the 100-mile riders have a breakfast, and then they're bused, and their bikes are hauled over to Troy, Montana. The 30 and 40 start at City Beach right around 11 or 11:15, right, I think, and then shortly thereafter. And all those rides have police escorts out. But the beauty is, and the fun part of it is, beginning at about 2 p.m. and going through about 8 p.m. is there's this community-wide. It's not just for the riders and their families. It's for the entire community. We have a community-wide party. There is a great dinner. There's a beer and wine garden. There's fun, exciting things. We've got announcers announcing the riders coming in. And when we talk to our riders, they tell us that it's one of the most fun rides that they have ever done in their life. And that includes big rides that are regional here as well.
Right, because the setting is right there at City Beach. And Trinity puts on such a great buffet for the after ride party. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, hard to top that. Well, we're about out of time. So Mel Dick and Ilana Westfall, thanks for coming in to tell us about the Chafe 150. The new cause for childhood literacy, and if somebody's inspired, they want to sign up, What do they do?
They go to chafe150.org, and they can just click through to the registration, get signed up right away.
Yeah.
And start fundraising.
Yeah, that's right. Get started training and fundraising early. Yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you to you both for coming in today, but also to the Rotary for putting this on, because it is really highlighting and showcasing Sandpoint as one of the most beautiful places. And I was going to say at the end, there's water you can swim and there's mountains you can gaze at. And that's, you know, what Sandpoint offers. And you have quite a few folks coming in from outside for this ride. And thank you for coming in. I'd like to have you back before, just to see how we're doing. Maybe a quick 10, 20-minute interview sometime in May. So we'll contact you.
We would love to do that. And thanks for the time this morning.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we just heard an interview with Ilana Westphal and Mel Dick from Chafe 150 Grand Fondo. You can hear all about it or read all about it at their website, www.chafe150.org. There we go. This is a group activity here. I want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show. We're just about out of time. A couple of announcements. Tomorrow on the morning show, Jim and Jack will have, their guests will be Heidi Carter and Brian Lorenzen, from hosts of something called the Death Cafe. You'll have to tune in at 8 o'clock to hear about that. And next week, speaking of the public school system, we will have a recorded interview with Sean Woodward from the Lake Ponderay School District to just get a little more information about the upcoming levy that's...
And Geraldine Lewis as well.
And Geraldine.
Who's on the board.
Great. And that levy is coming up on the...
March 12th.
March 12th. Yeah. Don't forget to register and vote. That's what we're here for, to encourage people to get involved in our community. What else?
Well, I don't know. What's happening with the weather again, real quick?
Okay, let's see. Right now it's
going to be cold. And maybe the wind's going to, we think the wind might be dying down a little bit.
The wind's dying down on Saturday morning. There's sunshine in the forecast, 25 degree high, but Saturday night, a low of 3.
Yes.
Cold. And cold. So,
cold. We'll just... because we know that March comes in like a lion, it'll go out like a lamb, right?
There you go. We're going to go out with one of my new favorite songs. This is Mira Bellot. It's As I Went Out One Morning. We hope that you have a beautiful day.
Bye now.
Bye.